Hello and welcome to the Celeste Stein Show, coming to you live from the greater Nashville area. Today, I'd like to begin by welcoming my three special guests, Dr. Pam Johnson, a journalism professor at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green, Kentucky. She is the first Black female publisher of a general circulation newspaper in the U.S., the Ithaca Journal out of New York. She also has served as the director of the Dow Jones News Fund for college interns and faculty from historically Black colleges and universities. I might also add that she graduated from the University of Wisconsin with a joint PhD in mass communication and educational psychology. And one last interesting fact, she's actually been invited to the White House on three occasions. Next, we have Wanda Lloyd, who is also a journalist and author by trade. Her recent memoir, Coming Full Circle from Jim Crow to Journalism, tells her own story about living in Savannah, Georgia, and then working for seven daily newspapers and founding and leading university programs to teach journalism, then coming back home and making a difference in her own childhood community. She has also served as the founding executive director for the Freedom Forum Diversity Institute, based on the campus of Vanderbilt University in Nashville. I should also mention that she is my Spelman sister. Welcome to the show. And finally, I'm delighted that Dr. Matthew Knowles could also join us today. Dr. Knowles is an author, professor, lecturer, public speaker, entrepreneur, music executive, artist manager, and founder of Music World Entertainment. His company is one of the world's leading music and entertainment conglomerates, with record sales exceeding 450 million worldwide, having worked with Chaka Khan, Earth, Wind & Fire, the OJs, Destiny's Child, and his daughters, Solange and Beyonce, just to name a few. Welcome to the show, and I sincerely thank each and every one of you for joining us today. I want to mention before we actually get started that we do have a call-in number, and I think we already have several people holding on the line, so we will get to you within the show. But if you do have a question and you want to hold that thought, the 800 number is 888-710-8061. We'd love to hear from you. I'm going to start off by saying, obviously, this week has been quite a week with the recent death of George Floyd at the hands and knee of a Minnesota police officer. This has set off mass protests and obviously civil unrest and several instances of violence, both civil rights and First Amendment rights as well. I'd like to start by asking each one of you if you feel a paradigm shift has occurred with the level of protests that we are seeing in terms of the number and types of people coming out against what has taken place here. Wanda, I'd like to start with you.
Sure. Good afternoon. I'm so glad to be here. Good morning to some of you.
Yes.
yes, I do feel a paradigm shift. I have spent a great deal of my professional capital, the years that I worked as a journalist, helping the media industry and other industries address the issues of diversity. I am so thrilled to see so many young people who are taking part in this movement. And this morning I was trying to think, what are we going to call it? You know, we had the civil rights movement. We had women's movement. We had voting rights. You know, there were all movements. And so I guess what I would wonder is, what are we going to call it? But I do believe that this is going to be a big change. You see so many trees falling, and by that I mean industries. You see people saying, oh my goodness, I had no idea. We have conversations with people who really didn't, in some cases, want to believe that some of us who are African American, no matter what our socioeconomic level is, had been through some of the struggles. And this is actually part of why I wrote the book. So I'm Coming Full Circle from Jim Crow to Journalism. And so I'm really encouraged that this is going to make a real difference. And I look forward to having a discussion about that.
Yes, I want to also hear from everyone here. Dr. Pam, would you like to weigh in on that? Do you think there has been a huge paradigm shift to occur here?
I think that there's a big shift in how people are thinking. For example, we're talking about Gen X and the millennials. And this is the largest group in the U.S. and in the whole world. So they have a completely different mindset than other people do. And the one thing that I'm so pleased to see about Black students or young Blacks is that they know their value. For example, my own daughter, when she applied to 5 different schools, she didn't get full scholarships. She got partial scholarships. So she worked for a year and a half, then went back. They gave her the same scholarships. And she said, oh, no, I'm more valuable. I've had this experience. I should get more money. And she did. I have a nephew who graduated from Howard University in law. And he had done all the right things, went to a very prestigious company in D.C., and he excelled there. One weekend, he had told them far in advance, my fiance is coming this weekend, I don't want to work. They called him into work. He left and went to California, and now he's got a nice practicing firm, and he is as a defender. And it goes on and on. A young woman who worked at the one of the major newspapers, she didn't feel that they were promoting her, so she moved on. So when I don't think people realize how much these people know their value. And when you know your value, you act differently. And also the white millennials, they value diversity and other groups didn't. And so I think that this is a sort of an interchange that a lot of people don't even recognize this there.
Yeah, very, very good points. What about you, Dr. Knowles?
It was well spoken. I couldn't agree more with the two doctors before. But some context on my answer to your question. I grew up in Gaston, Alabama, 1952. I never went to a Black school. My mother went to high school with Coretta King. I integrated, desegregated elementary school, junior high school, Gaston High School, University of Tennessee. I only went to a Black school my last 2 years of college there at Fisk before I went on to higher education. I've been spit on, electric, prodded, beaten, and I've seen so many paradigm shifts. And as the guest before me, I teach young people. This is my 12th year. I'm at Prairie View A&M this semester. And I'm so proud of the social courage, that's the name I give it, of our young people, the ability to speak up, speak out, speak against sooner, quicker, faster than we did about racism, xenophobia, homophobia. Mm-hmm. And I think integration, about 15 years ago, kicked in a special way. And we see these young people, and we see also their white counterparts. They went to elementary school together. They played sports together. They dated each other, and in some cases married and had children. It's a different society now. These young people know how to scale, as we use in business. They understand the power of social media. It's our role, though. It's our role to support, and I call old folks because I'm 68 years old, it's our role to get away, let these young people through, and almost act as if we're an advisory board to them. We first need to find the leaders, give them our support, and let them do their thing. And trust them. They will make some mistakes. We all did. But that's how we all grow. But we have to do a conversion here. Marching is great. The conversion is voting. Because if we don't vote, all of this was for naught.
Mm-hmm. Very, very true. But, it's interesting. My next question was actually about the leadership you just mentioned. And that is, where should we be looking, or where should our young people especially be looking for leadership at a time like this?
Well, in normal times, we would be looking at the top of our government. That's really where the leadership ought to come. And it has, you know, in some ways in past times, you know, President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. There have been, President Obama spoke out against racism. So many leaders, government leaders have done that. That would be where we should be looking. But, you know, we're looking for leadership in organizations. We're looking for leadership in coalitions. We're looking for leadership in education. We're looking for leadership still in the faith community, which has changed from the time we grew up. The faith community is younger in some cases. It addresses religion in different ways. It addresses worship in different ways. And so there, you know, I don't think our leadership is going to come from one person. I don't think we're going to have, especially in my lifetime, another Martin Luther King type leader who everyone sort of follows. We really are looking for a coalition of leaders.
Right, because I think, you know, as I was growing up and working as a journalist, I think about, you know, there were several people over the years we looked up to, like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and some of our civil rights activists in Atlanta, Julian Bond, and just so many people that paved the way, Andrew Young, Maynard Jackson. I could go on and on.
Right,
but
right.
Now I think I'm seeing in the much younger generations, like Martin Luther King's grandchild, hearing her speech, it was just incredible. I was definitely wowed with her. And I've seen some other very young folks that seem to be the ones that are emerging up in terms of leadership. But I think that the broad perspective of looking in all these different areas for leadership is also important too. Dr. Pam, would you like to weigh in on that?
Yes, I don't think they're looking for leaders. I think we're going to see them as more of a grassroots movement rather than, you know, looking for leadership. Also, they have worked in teams. They have been educated to work in teams. And so I think that it's going to be on a more grassroots level, and they will be very powerful there. And so they don't really think that they need a leader. It's not that they don't need a leader. They're just able to work without one. And I was very pleased, though, to hear some of them say, talk about Dr. King. This is his dream coming true. This is Dr. So it's not that they don't respect our leaders. They, you know, just were in adoration of him. But it's just that I think that they're more of a grassroots movement.
Right, but I noticed that we did see a lot of looting, and I certainly don't think that was his vision. The whole vision obviously was a nonviolent movement, and there were lots of things done that were very effective, like the boycotts. And I will just say that we still have not evolved to things like that. I mean, I'm seeing it here or there, but it just does not seem to be an organized effort.
I think that you will see that. I think that these people, these millennials and Generation X, are strategic thinkers. And I think that that's going to come out. And I think that the looters, they were people from outside. And you're always going to have them. For example, I was just thinking the other day, what if after a march, or we don't even need a march to have it, we have learning sessions or learning teams, whatever you want to call them, and we educate them about the history. Why are you doing this? Some of them don't know. Like Wanda said that she included information about Jim Crow in her book because she found that so many people didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. Our mind is more powerful than a gun. We just have to put the information in.
Mm-hmm. Wanda, I'd like to kind of come back to you on that.
Sure.
In the book. You know, what prompted you actually to move in the direction, you know, to tell that particular story?
Well, one of the things that prompted me was when I left my last newsroom, and I came to Savannah and was a professor and chair of the Department of Journalism and Mass Comm at Savannah State University. I started interacting with students on a daily basis, and I would have to sit down with all the seniors in order for them to get through their matriculation and graduate. And as we sat and talked and had kind of a career chat, many of them asked me for my story. What was my story? Because they knew I hadn't been in the academy all my career. And I started telling them that I was from Savannah originally. I left Savannah in 1967 that I lived through the Jim Crow era, and they went, Jim, what is that? They had not had these conversations in school. They had not had these conversations with their parents. For whatever reason, their grandparents had not told those grandparents who had grown up in Jim Crow like I did. People weren't talking about it. It is almost as if in school they studied slavery and Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Movement. And they missed that whole step of this legal separation that we lived in the 1950s and 1960s. So that's largely what prompted me, in addition to inspiring young people like the Gen X's and the millennials that Dr. Pam just talked about, inspiring them, using my stories to inspire them to become successful and understand what it takes to be successful. A lot of hard work, a lot of education, a lot of coalition building, a lot of understanding the past. So that's what really inspired the book.
Yeah, and Dr. Knowles has also written a book on racism and growing up in America. Dr. Knowles, would you like to elaborate a little bit on also what prompted your book and talk a little bit about that, please?
Well, my book is Racism from the Eyes of a Child. And I wanted to go back, and it was therapy almost for me. And I talk about in my book the 10 years of therapy that I have gone through because of racial trauma. A lot of people didn't get it, but I'm sure you get it now when I was talking about racial trauma. Folks, I've looked at racism. I've looked it in the eye, getting the hell beat out of me by state troopers. I'm not talking about it, intellectualizing about it. I look racism in the eye, and it's ugly. And I wanted to share that and how I internalized a whole lot of things as a child and how that affected me as an adult. And I want to share those stories, how racism exists outside of my childhood in corporate America, in the music industry. And I think we all understand that today. But I do want to just, the question before, I think it's important that we understand Dr. Martin Luther King was 23 years old. Malcolm X was 29 years old. The two brothers at the Black Panthers, one was 23, the other one was 29. All the folks, Jesse, all the people you name, they were all in their 20s, folks. They were young. And yes, we absolutely need leadership. Leadership is critical in an organizational culture. But the question is, we can do things at a local level today. Change can occur at a local level immediately from our mayors. And we got so many Black mayors. Why can't they call these police chiefs and tell them what the policies are? Why is it when I look on TV and I see these demonstrations, I see these big football player looking white boys as police officers? Is there no Black police officers? I'm confused.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for allowing me to just to have a conversation.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, I think there needs to really be more of this, as Dr. Pam mentioned about just the whole education component of this, because I think about community policing, and the fact is, you know, covering communities in five different cities over the years as a journalist, one of the things that I noticed in covering a lot of stories of this nature where people may have protested is that there was a disconnect. There were people who were policing in areas that they did not live. And so a lot of times those would be young people, rookies who unfortunately did not have a lot of experience in the communities that they serve. So I feel like if they were working within those communities early on, where it wasn't like separate, where somebody's going off into the suburbs and, you know, then coming every day into the inner city to deal with some of those issues, that you get to know people. And that's really what it's about, starting to really get to understand and know people at the basic grassroots level, and then you can have a better idea of how to serve those communities. Because obviously, you know, many of the folks pay taxes, but they talk about unequal, you know, taxation without, you know, fair representation. And so those are things that we have got to start to demand, I think, as a community, as a nation.
So Les, I really believe that there's an analogy between what you just said about police officers going into different communities and journalism. Because, you know, at the beginning of my advocacy for diversity in journalism, we found that we had journalists who were not comfortable covering certain communities. And it was not just training Black reporters or bringing in Black reporters or Black and brown reporters, or women for that matter. But it was a matter of making sure the white reporters understood the whole community. I mean, to the extent that one of my seven newspapers, I think maybe two of them newsrooms, I hired a bus and I took the entire staff on a tour of the community because I thought it was important because they kept hearing about this other community that they never set foot in. And I think, quite frankly, I think some of them were afraid to go there. But I wanted, and I had a tour guide who was a historian and who could talk about the rich history of this community and the pride of the people who live there, who many of whom were foot soldiers in the civil rights movement, their parents and their grandparents, and saved money and made money so that they could educate their future generations with pride. And now they're taking pride in the grandchildren who may not live in that community anymore, but who are making significant contributions, not only in their local cities, but in other places. This is a culture, I think. This is a culture education that's needed. And I will go back to the fact that it really crosses socioeconomic. You know, the day that a friend reminded me over last week or this week while we were going through this, the day I moved back to Savannah in 2013, we were unpacking. The movers had just left. They dropped off all these boxes, and my friend was in the house with my husband, and we were unpacking. The doorbell rang. There was a police officer at my door. I live in a fairly affluent neighborhood that's mostly white, not all, but mostly white. And someone had called the police to say that there were Black people in this house. Now, this was 2013.
Your own house.
In my own house. Imagine, you know, we're packing boxes and setting up the kitchen. So, you know, things like that happen. I have not been beaten, I have to say. You know, I have been stopped. Other members of my family have been stopped while driving while Black, driving a nice car, I'm sure. So we really have, it's a culture shift that has to change minds in this country to understand that people are people, and that some of us are striving to be to get to the next level of the socioeconomic level, and some of us may have already arrived, but we're all feeling the hardships of this culture that people don't understand.
Right. That something you said reminded me of when I was in school at Northwestern for my master's program in journalism. I was in a class. I was the only African-American in that class. And, you know, we had about a dozen students, and many of them were from all over the country, but training to be the future journalists. And our professor asked them, how many of you have ever, you know, covered anything, you know, within, say, a community and culture that's different from your own. And one girl raised her hand. She said, "This is the first time I've ever been in a room from where I came from with someone else of color." And I just looked, I was like, so, you know, the conversation was opened at that point to talk about the fact that the only thing she knew about people of color that looked like me were things that she saw in the movies and on television. And obviously some of that is a little exaggerated at times. It may not be quite accurate. So just like in any race, there are good and bad people in all races. And so it's getting to know people and really being able to understand the differences and nuances in culture, I believe. One thing I'm noticing that we do have a couple of people kind of on standby. And so I think I'm going to take a quick break to see if we'd like to have anyone chime in and ask a question of anyone on the panel at this point. We will, let's see who I have here. Jim Snodgrass, if we could open his mic, allow him to ask the question. Jim, are you there? Hello? Okay, he says he's not able to unmute him. Let me try that. Let's see. I have, okay. Can you hear us, Jim? I see your mic is unmuted. Hello? I see also we have, if you want to ask your question in the chat, if we're unable to unmute, we also have Rexana, I believe, Lester on standby. If you would like to ask your question, we can hear you. Hello?
Hi, I'm just listening.
Yes.
I really don't have a question yet. I just want to listen.
Okay, great.
I'm here to learn.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for listening. And I think, I don't know, Jim, if you're able, I don't know if you have a question, but I know your mic is open now. Okay, well, we'll continue. And if you'd like, we can also get your questions on the chat. So feel free to, you know, just type your question into the chat room and we will get to you as soon as possible.
So Lester, if you don't mind, I would, Rexana is a friend of mine. She's a white friend in Savannah.
Okay.
We've been friends probably since the 90s. We actually met in Washington at the White House. And she's a former executive editor of the paper in Savannah. But what I wanted to say is there are people like Rexana and others who really are trying to learn. And I think we should put ourselves in a space where we can help people learn. You know, she's learned a lot from me and from others. But there are other people who are trying to learn. And I would hope that when this movement settles out and some of the protests end, because they will end, we can't sustain this kind of protest forever. I would hope that somehow a structure is created where people individually in small groups, in small communities, in small organizations will find a safe space where people can have these conversations, where people can talk honestly about things that happened to me, things that happened to Dr. Knowles as he talked about being beaten. People, you know, you get to a certain point in your life and you think, well, he's good. Nothing bad has ever happened to him in terms of race relations, but it has. It's happened to all of us. So I would hope that we can create those kinds of cultures where people really can have conversations.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think a lot of times people are shocked to actually hear from people like us who have experienced these types of situations, because there are times as a journalist, especially, I found myself in some very interesting and tight spots that I never expected to be in a million years, but things do, you know, transpire. But one of the things—
Let me just hone in. I love yes. what was just said, because yes. if you're a Black person, and if you've ever flown on an airplane, checked in a hotel, went to a prominent restaurant, for example, we're fortunate and grateful my wife and I fly first class. We live in another city other than Houston. Just recently, I wear, like you see me now, sweater, pair of jeans, and some tennis shoes. I don't get all dressed up. I'm putting my bags up, and a flight attendant comes, sir, that's reserved for first class. That hasn't happened just one time, two times, three times, four times, several times. That happened. The perception. And when we talk about, and I heard the word structure, I call it structural racism. Hmm. When we look at our poverty level, our housing, our educational level, health and wealth, welfare, the criminal justice system, it's a whole structure of racism that has to be changed. There's no happenstance that we look at COVID-19, and by the way, folks, the media seem to forgot that COVID-19 is a pandemic, and a whole bunch of people next week is going to be sick and some dying. I don't understand that. That's a conversation in and on how it went from 1,000 to zero, where the Jedi mind trick all the time. But anyway, you know, it's just time for change. It's just time.
I also had a comment. There are a lot of apps. I was surprised at how many, and they're geared toward all different age ranges and topics. And so people can go on and look at those individually as well as use them in discussions for any groups. But there are a lot of apps now that will talk about racism.
Yeah, one of the things I'd like to point out, since we were also talking about being journalists and journalism, one thing that I have seen recently that I have never seen before is the arrest of the CNN reporter Omar Jimenez, who happens to be my Spellman sister's son, who reports for CNN, that he was arrested in the middle of doing his job. It's not like they couldn't see the CNN camera in front of him. I just, you know, what about that and the destruction here of our First Amendment rights as journalists to be able to speak out and to tell these stories that are so important so that history does not repeat itself.
And Omar wasn't the only journalist. I saw a tweet the other day, I think it was yesterday or the day before, a young brother was in Birmingham and he tweeted, "I'm in jail, I was arrested. I was covering the march in Birmingham." Somebody, you know, reach out to his boss at whatever news organization he works for. I'm sure there were many, many others. It is a First Amendment issue. You know, there are five freedoms in the First Amendment. And the first freedom that I thought about as we started this was the right to petition the government in a peaceable way for redress. And then I started thinking about, of course, when Omar was arrested, the freedom of the, you know, freedom of the press. And he is a part of that. And then, you know, we saw someone standing in front of a church with a Bible probably upside down. And I thought, well, wait a minute, this is not what the four forefathers intended when they put freedom of religion in the First Amendment. I think we have a question in the chat now.
Let me see.
The Zoom chat, I see.
Okay.
Maybe a couple.
Okay, from Jim.
Oh, Rexanna says she has a question. She wanted to get back on.
And I also see Jim Snodgrass. He apologizes, his mic is not working, but I'll read this. He says, "I'm a white citizen with close friends of all races. I was greatly disturbed by what I've seen with these events with Mr. Floyd and Mr. Aubrey and others, and frankly was shocked at the magnitude of the problem. My question is, the topic naturally makes all persons uncomfortable. But I think it's vital all races unite to drive change. What advice would your panelists provide to white supporters on how we can truly help?" Who wants to take a stab at that?
Well, I would start by saying, when you see something wrong, you know, point it out. People just kind of walk by and say, "Oh, well, that's their issue." I'm not telling anybody to put their life in jeopardy. That's not really what I'm talking about. It could be in your workplace. It could be in a store where someone is refusing to serve you in a place of business. You know, I remember walking through Neiman Marcus years ago, and I asked a lady to let me see a piece of jewelry that was under the counter. It wasn't fine jewelry, it was just under the counter. And she told me, "Oh, that's expensive." Well, you know, I didn't ask her how much it costs. So when you see something wrong like that, you really need to, I think that's the first thing that I would suggest. Others may have other suggestions.
Mm-hmm. Either of you, Dr. Pam?
I think that white people can also educate other white people. For example, if I were sitting in a room of all blacks and we were talking and a white person came in, you know, the room would go quiet and I would nod my head, you know, and that means, oh, he's okay. And so I think it's that, when I was, well, for example, my boss asked me to head the diversity committee. And I said, no, I think white people should have the diversity committee, because when I run a diversity committee, they think that I want them to like me. I don't want white people to necessarily like me. I want them to get out of the way so I can do what I need to do. So if we have racist policies in our business and that policy is there, if I'm working for that company and I'm going to follow their policy, I have to follow a racist policy. So wherever I'm working, I should look at those systems and see where we can change them. I think people can work from where they are. If you're a teacher, you know, work with other teachers and see what kind of things you can put in your curriculum. I don't think that you can't force someone to be friends. For example, if someone said to me, Pam, you need more white friends. Well, I can't just go up to a white person and say, I want to be your friend. But what you can do is put yourself in situations where you are normally attracted to a kind of person, black, whatever, that you would be friends with. So I don't think it's something that, I think it's something that we can be proactive, but I don't think it's as hard as we sometimes think it is.
Right, and it doesn't have to be forced, but right. You know, sometimes it's just people naturally kind of separate and tend to draw close to those people that are like them, when often they should be seeking out people that might be slightly different. Dr. Knowles, did you want to add anything there?
Yeah, it goes back to the social courage that I talked about earlier, but I want to applaud the two people that just spoke and asked questions to white people. I think it's time that we stop being uncomfortable saying black and white. You know, people get so uptight. You know, they use the music, we use the pop division and the urban division. You know, let's stop that. Let's be real. And I think it's these type of dialogues. I wish it was all white people listening right now. I love when a woman said, I'm listening. That was beautiful. We do have our differences. Culturally, we have differences. Let's talk about them. Let's talk about the subconscious of racism, that a number of white people, there's never all, but a number of white people feel privileged. Let's talk about what privileged racism looks like. Mm. Let's get it all out on the table. Change is supposed to make you uncomfortable. It's not supposed to make you feel good. It's supposed to make you feel bad. And that's how we change, is we get it all out.
Yeah.
And so I applaud having these types of dialogues, and we need to have more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's been great thus far. Wanted to note, we have a caller on the line from Georgia. I don't know if that's Frida. Is she still there? And see if our engineers could pull her up. And then also, I believe Rexana also had a question now. Are you able to, okay. I think your mic's open.
My mic is open. I was going to turn on the video, but I can't do that right now. But I can just talk. And it kind of follows on what you were just talking about. This week, I met with some white people in a park, just three or four friends. They're really good friends of mine. And I was actually in a rage over what has happened and what was happening. And they were afraid of my rage. I can't imagine if it had really been a tense situation. These are very good friends of mine. But I couldn't get my arms around what was happening. And then when I calmed down a little bit, several of them started talking. And essentially, they're afraid of doing the wrong thing. And it kind of paralyzes them. A bunch of us are going to go this afternoon. There's a meeting in Forsyth Park, which is our big park in Savannah. And it's a group of people. And I actually got notices from both black and white friends who said, come. So I think it's going to be a mixed group, which was really amazing about the marches here. It was a very open, friendly, big, I mean, it was intense, but it was very mixed group. But I'm having trouble dealing with white people who are even afraid of me, another white person, talking about race. Wow. And I find that, but what you guys said really, I mean, it's what I'm thinking. You know, they have to put themselves in uncomfortable positions. They have to learn to read. And I loved what several people have said over the last week is we have to be neighbors, whether we live together or not. Until we can think of each other as neighbors, we can't really think of how we want to treat each other. So anyway, you really answered my question, and I just wanted to say thank you, and I will continue to listen.
Thank you. Well, it's interesting that you're bringing the point up that you did, but a lot of people have turned a deaf ear when Colin Kaepernick, you know, decided to bend a knee. You know, he was called out for that. Of course, now the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, is saying that the league was wrong for not listening to the players about racism. So, you know, I think this is the one time that people are starting to think, hey, maybe there is an actual issue here. I think many African Americans and people of color have known that this is something that has been desperately wrong for quite some time. But the willingness to speak out about it, you know, there people are very uncomfortable. I have several friends that, you know, when a lot of things were going on politically, you know, a lot of people were defriending other people on platforms like Facebook and Instagram as some of the dialogue was coming out. And some of it, you know, was based on fake news, as we all know. But I think that the more we can open up and talk about it, certainly the better. One of the things I'd like to kind of move on to is talking a little bit quickly and briefly about the coronavirus and the fact that so many, you know, 43 million Americans, nearly 43 million are out of work. How worried are you all about the future with that? Because there doesn't really seem to be talk of any type of strategic game plan as to what actually is happening here. Are we phasing back into work? How many businesses are we going to lose? There are so many questions when it comes to that, and how are we going to actually deal with what's going to happen over the next couple of months? Any of you can certainly feel free to take a stab at that one.
Well, I'll start. We're all parents, all of us, mm-hmm. and all of us on this chat. And I fear for our children. I fear for the generation of our children and our grandchildren, because most of us are at a point where we're pretty secure and weren't affected by it. I'm retired, and so the money I had in January, I have in June. It didn't change. But I think about my own daughter, who is in her late 30s, who works for an industry that may become vulnerable. She's still working, thank God, but it may become vulnerable. There are a lot of young people who work in service jobs. And if those service jobs don't come back, if those businesses don't come back, I really fear for them. I really think about the fact that when I was in my career, if I needed to change a job, I could always go to another city. Everybody's not that flexible. Everybody doesn't have that opportunity to just pick up and move and go somewhere else where the jobs are. And so, you know, I think we need to look at the structure of jobs. There goes that word again, Dr. Noel. Structure. The structure of jobs, you know. Right. How do we create positions in our own community so that people can stay together? I personally lived in 8 states. That's just what I did, but everybody's really not willing to do that. That yes. is the starting point.
Yeah. Dr. Knowles, I know the entertainment industry is what we all look to be able to escape and be able to come home and relax, or we normally like to go to a movie or a nice concert or what have you, but obviously that has completely changed. I mean, what are you seeing as the future there of entertainment?
First of all, what a great panel. But, you know, entertainment, I want to just briefly in entertainment go back to Colin Kaepernick, because white owners, white people did not, even white football players who we heard Drew Brees put his foot in his mouth yesterday, day before, they didn't understand what this brother did had nothing to do with the flag. Nothing to do. And they didn't get it. And that's the dialogue that a lot of white people don't really get what we're saying. But to entertainment, you know, it's tough. It's going to be a while before you see artists on the stage or you're able to go to a play, you know. And it goes back to that structural racism. It's no surprise that we lead in a death rate because we lead in a mortality rate of heart disease and cancer and every other major mortality rate of health and wellness. So is that a surprise? Is it a surprise that of the 30 million, 10 million Blacks are out of work? Well, we lead in a poverty rate per capita. So is that a surprise? So it's a structural circle of racism that has to be fixed. But, you know, I came from, and I'm proud to say, I'm the third generation entrepreneur. My daughters, they make the fourth generation of entrepreneurship. And we have to go back. I always say in the 60s and 70s, the only people that truly integrated were us. We moved out of our neighborhoods to white neighborhoods. We moved our businesses out of our neighborhood. We integrated. Nobody else did. We had different people come into our area. When, you know, my former wife and I and my friend Tina, we had a hair salon for 17 years. It was unheard of having other than a Black nail technician. It was unheard of. I mean, we have to go back also and look at that. Economics of all of this, and how do we keep our dollars into our communities? Even if a business is out of our community, how do we support Black businesses? And you said it's the lesson in the very beginning. How do we boycott? We're looking at the owner of the Houston Rockets, the owner who also owns a lot of restaurants. The guy is a personal friend of our president and donates millions of dollars. Like, we still support this man. We've got to stop doing that and start supporting our own.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And getting back to something I think Dr. Pam said earlier about education, I want to talk a little bit also about how far you all think this might set are young people who have often also disparities in education, not only healthcare, it's just all across the board. You know, everybody can't afford to have, like, if they have five kids, to have a computer for each child. So how is this going to impact families in that way as well, with parents out of work, no place to take the children for daycare, and no plan for the future?
I think that people on the corporate level should probably be doing more. For example, we don't have Blacks on corporate boards. And I also think that there are groups that are in place that can help and teach our students. For example, the NAACP, 100 Black Men, if we all in those kinds of groups take on a topic that's what we're going to work on for this year, then I think that we can make some progress. So we have whites and Blacks, you know, moving together. I also remember that on-the-job training was very successful in the late 60s. And I think that that's something that we can take a look at too. And I think that if companies are willing to do that, that could be a whole entree into the workforce that, you know, some young people don't have right now.
Right. I know sometimes the only thing someone can do is throw money at a problem, but that doesn't necessarily resolve the issue because a lot of dollars have gone into protests and what have you over the years. What else can those companies be doing in terms of leading the folks in making sure that the dialogues are open, but that we are actually seeing change that is effective.
You know, in the 1970s, I believe, a lot of the large corporations, IBM, Xerox, companies like that, opened their doors and started internship programs, started mentoring programs for mm-hmm. students who were in college, started, you know, offering scholarships to help young students who were in high school go to school. And they were tracking these students. I mean, those are dollars, but they're also, it's also a way to reach out and touch personally when you bring people into your company and you mentor them and you train them in that way. Money does help, you know, it really does. I read a story at the beginning of the coronavirus of a mother who had four or five children in the car. She put them in the car every day because they couldn't afford internet access. And she'd take them to, I don't know, outside of McDonald's, I think, and sit in the parking lot because they had internet so that they could literally do their homework in the car. They couldn't go inside because, you know, we were shut down, but they could do it in the car. We need to, you know, corporations do need to put money behind certain things, like making sure that people have access, because the internet is the world now. You know, you can't do anything without internet, and our children need that. In Savannah, our superintendent reached out to corporations and collected money to get computers, laptop computers, for students who didn't have access. Because you're right, you started out by saying a mother with five children. If the mother is at home working, and sometimes they are working from home and sometimes they're in service jobs, but if they have four or five children, they can't all do their homework on one computer. They all need their own device so that they can get that work done in a timely manner. This is a critical example of this economic disparity that needs to be addressed in the United States, because education is different from what it was. I hear Dr. Knoll say he integrated schools. We've gone, you know, schools are integrated. Now schools are resegregated in a lot of communities. I don't know that a lot of my white sisters and brothers even know that has happened. You know, they don't even think about the fact that we were black schools and we were integrated, and now we're black again and we're white again. And you know, I lived in Montgomery, Alabama, as my last newspaper town. And, you know, when I got there, a lot of the white parents had sent their kids to private schools, even the ones who couldn't afford it. They somehow found a way to make sacrifices in other areas so that they could send their kids to private schools. And so I got to Montgomery as executive editor of the newspaper to find that 90-some% of the school system, the public school system, was black and not funded well enough for them to go to the universities that that Dr. Pam has worked at, and some other universities. So it all does kind of begin with economics, I think. That plus having these conversations. I really think that having conversations about race is also another area that we can address some of these disparities, because people really need to know. And what we're finding out with this movement is that there really indeed are a lot of people who just don't know. They don't know about the disparities. They don't know about why people are angry. They don't know about when people say, be patient, time will come, changes will come. No, we can't be patient anymore. That's what these young people are saying. We're not going to be patient. The time is now. We need those changes right now, today.
Yeah. Dr. Knowles, I saw you shaking your head. Did you want to add something?
I was just loving what was being said. Loving what was being said. And it just reminded me so many things. Just going back to the corporate world, you know, I worked at Xerox for 10 years from 78 to 88, and was fortunate to be the number one sales rep worldwide at Xerox Medical System 3 out of 4 years, and was president of Minorities United in the Southern Region, which covered half of the United States and all the black employees. And we had an organization and we had leadership, and we met with senior management on a routine monthly basis, and we shared and voiced our concerns, and we had seminars with all the white sales and marketing teams, and we shared. That stopped somewhere. Those type of dialogues and organizations stopped in corporate America. We forget Fortune 500 corporations in America, there's only 4 black CEOs out of 500 top Fortune 500 companies. That says a lot right there. That says a whole lot. So it's about leadership and dialogue. We've said Montgomery, Alabama. We've said Atlanta. We've said Minneapolis, St. Paul. We've said Houston. They all got black mayors. we shouldn't be in this position of police brutality.
Yeah.
And we got to hold black policemen accountable because they're in this fraternity and they turn their head. We got to hold them accountable. We got to hold our black mayors accountable.
Yeah, so you're talking about government, you know, right there. And that's another thing. I know in other countries, they're doing things like they mail masks to families like every week for the number of people they have in their household and things like that with the coronavirus going on. I seems to be definitely not enough going on at the government level to really protect people, to give people. I mean, I think a lot's being done in terms of information, but I don't know. It's a disconnect with, I would really say it's a lack of trust a lot of times within the African-American community. I mean, because of things that obviously have happened in the past. But should the government be stepping up more and doing more with what's happened?
I think all levels should be stepping up. For example, at the memorial service, Sharpton said that someone had donated some money for a scholarship. And he said, you know, what if all university presidents said, we're going to start a scholarship too? Well, that's where presidents can do something. And imagine if around the whole United States that happened. My president at the university had the day before sent out this letter about how we're all going to be trained and blah, blah, blah. And so when I heard Sharpton say that, I decided that I was going to send my president a check and say, here's my check for the scholarship. And so I think that that's our ways that we can get things moving. You can do it from your level wherever you are.
Yeah. Any other things as we're wrapping up here? I think any final thoughts? We'll start with you, Dr. Knowles, and we'll go to Wanda and Dr. Pam, and we'll wrap up. Just final thoughts on things that could be done to mitigate the level of violence.
Yeah, I mean, coming to education, Dr. Ruth Simmons at Prairie View A&M University, where I teach, just came out with a memo, email, that said, moving forward at Prairie View, every freshman student moving forward, mandatory will take a Black History type class to begin letting our young people understand where we come from and the challenges and help build leadership. And I'll just share a quick story. I was going down the escalator at LAX and a nun from Mexico was asking for money. I gave, and she gave me a business card. I always end with this. It said, pray not for a life free from trouble. Pray for triumph over trouble. For what you and I called adversity, God, the universe, whatever name, calls opportunity. In adversity, there's opportunity. This is a time that we all have to step up and have the social courage. Thank you.
Thank you. Wanda?
Well, two things. One is I think when Dr. Pam mentioned leadership and, you know, how corporate boards need to look at the leadership structure, how we realize that we only have four CEOs who are African-American in the Fortune 500, leadership at all levels. And my quick story is when I was in my career, I used to always say, when I grew up, I had served on lots of nonprofit boards, and I, of course, never get paid for things like that, and that's a good thing. But I used to say, when I grow up, I want to be a professional board person because I want to get paid for it, but I also want to help corporations and entities to understand the value of diversity. And so I would say, understanding the value of diversity at every level. Diversity is a good thing, whether it's diversity of color, gender, sexual orientation, religion, diversity of political thought. It's a good thing as long as we have these dialogues and we keep talking and we keep doing things to get us to the next level. I don't think it will ever end. We can always improve. And then the second thing is hope. I have hope in these young people. I have hope that we're at a point now where things will change. And I just want to continue to have hope and belief that they will make a difference and that those of us in our generation will accept that change and work with them.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Pam, and we have really got to wrap it up.
This is fast. Dr. King said that racism gives some people a false sense of superiority and gives other people a false sense of inferiority.
Well, thank you so much. This has been very eye-opening, and I hope it gave a lot of information to folks that were tuning in and will continue to hear this. That's all the time we have for now. I do want to mention, don't forget to social distance, wear the mask, get tested, and stay safe. Thanks for watching.